Good evening. This is Lesbian Nation.
If you were a carpenter and I were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Would you have my baby? If a tinker were your trade, would you still find me carrying the pots you made, following behind me? See my love through loneliness, see my love for sorrow. I've given you my onlyness, come give me your tomorrow.
Anytime, Joan.
Hands in wood, would you still love me? Answer me, baby, yes I would. I'd put you above me. And if you were a miller, had a mill wheel grinding, would you see it written on my face? I'm here for the finding. See my love for sorrow. I've given you my onlyness. Come give me your tomorrow. If you were a carpenter and I were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Would you have my baby?
I've got one announcement tonight. Speaking of having babies, the Amazon Media Project is presenting two videotapes, one of them called Lesbian Mothers, and one called Lesbianism Feminism. They're by Norma Pontes and Rita Moreira, March 22nd and 23rd at 8 p.m. at the Video Study Center, 454 Broome Street, between Mercer and Green. It's for women only, and there's a suggested contribution of $2. Tonight, we've got some more Judy Grand for you, lucky people. She'll be reading from a short story, part of a novel, really. And she'll be reading some more poetry.
I work with a group of people called the Women's Press Collective in Oakland, California. And we've been working at trying to learn printing. We do everything on no money at all. We just do it. Borrow $50 here or there, whatever, and invest all of our labor in it, and then hope that it comes back as the books sell, which is happening to a certain extent. But I wanted to run through some other people's things just to give you a sense of the kind of things we're printing before I get into my own books. And because I think I'm beginning to get an overall sense of the kind of literature that it's possible for women to put out, that it doesn't have to be some kind of an upper-class trip, that in fact most women's literature so far has been an upper-class trip of one kind or another, since the basis of writing a book is, say, 2 years of free time without having to do anything, not change diapers or do anything. So I think that's the reason why I always liked the idea of poetry, and I never really liked poetry until just recently when women picked up on it and started using it. And right now I like the idea of novels, but I don't especially like that many novels that have been written. And I have a feeling that it's because literature has belonged to a great extent, a certain group of people, and to try to break away from that, we have to learn how to provide for each other enough time to actually get something done. Doesn't mean you devote the rest of your life to some kind of art or communication or whatever, but just that somebody who really has something to say has 2 months or a year, if possible, to sit down and do it. And I know that's what our household is sort of into, providing each other with that kind of space or support, meaning financial support, not just spiritual support, though both of them are important. So I want to begin with a chapter from a woman's autobiographical novel that we were fortunate enough to get hold of and to have someone put up enough money that we can get started on printing it. She's somebody who is just like anybody here and didn't set out to break any literary records or write a bestseller or anything like that, but had a rough life, as most people do, and fell apart at some point when she was about 26 years old or so, and hid out in her parents' garage trying to put her own head back together and understand what had been happening to her. And in the process of it, she wrote down her life story, and it turned out to be a 24-chapter book, which is very incredible. It's called Yesterday's Lessons. Her name is Sharon Isabel, and the people I work with are printing it right now, so we hope to have it out in about 5 weeks. So I thought I'd read a chapter of it. This chapter comes right after she's been in the Army and then out of the Army and has gone back home again and is having a lot of trouble with jobs and finally bought a motorcycle to cheer herself up, and two of her best friends got on the motorcycle without knowing what they were doing and crashed it. So she went home and drank a bunch of beer and swallowed a lot of pills and cut her wrists and went to the hospital with the intention of dying, and didn't die. So this is chapter 17. It's very highly action-packed book. I couldn't leave the hospital until I saw the psychiatrist and he released me. I walked in his office and the first thing he asked me was, "What did you do, get in a fight with your girlfriend? What makes you think I got a girlfriend? I'm going to release you and I want you to understand that you can get psychiatric help here at the hospital. Is there anything you want to talk about before you go? No. Okay, you can go." Maybe I was crazy. I sure was ending up in a lot of psychiatrists' offices. Jan said that the girls on the first team I played for found out about me trying to kill myself and said they thought I was a mixed-up kid. She said when they found out about that, they really lost their faith in me. Well, what was I going to do? I didn't want anyone to believe in me because there was something in me that just wasn't any good, and it sure was a mistake when I didn't die. Bo is her next-door neighbor. Bo came over to see me, and she said that I had insisted that she stay in the room with me when they were sewing me up and everything. She said she held my hand through the whole thing. Bo was really nice, and she talked to me, and I felt she understood. There was something very warm about her. She wasn't pretty or femme on the outside, but she seemed to have all her beauty on the inside. She thought and looked at things in a way that made everything seem all right. I was beginning to like her more every time I saw her. I was riding my bike around the block and was turning a corner in second gear very slowly, and my bike slid in some gravel, and down I went. I thought I just skinned my knee, and I was worried about my bike being messed up. The corner was by Bo's house, and she was standing outside. I went over to talk to her, and she asked me if I was okay. I said yes and was looking at my bike, and it was okay. "Sharon, look at your knee. It's really bad." Well, Bo took me to the hospital again, and all I could think of was my mom and dad were really going to be mad, and I would probably never get to ride my bike again. My knee was a mess. It was all crushed and had a big hole in it. The doctor cleaned it out and said he couldn't sew much together because it was such a mess. The flesh was all torn and the bone was showing. He could only get 3 stitches in it and gave me some stuff to put on it. My leg was stiff, and my mom and dad were disgusted in me, and I was disgusted in me, too. My dad had to go back to Reading to work, and I had to go, too. I couldn't be left alone because I might try and kill myself again. Reading is really something. The temperature was about 120. We were staying in this little town outside of Reading called Cottonwood. My sister Billy's husband, Chester, was working with my dad on the construction job. Billy and the kids had to stay in Pittsburgh. Dad was the best heavy equipment operator they had, and they usually gave him all of the hardest jobs. He never missed a day of work and was never late, and he worked very hard. Dad was 59, and his life of hard work was beginning to show. His hands were one solid callus, and he had to wear a support for his back. The foreman of the company was giving Dad a bad time and adding to everything else. Mom and Dad were worried about Dad lasting until he could retire. Even when you were in the house, you could hardly stand the heat. The guys on the construction crew took salt tablets and wore hats, but the sun beat down on them with its giant fists. Chester had to work inside of the trench they were digging. This one day, after he'd been in the trench for quite a while, Dad stopped the machine he was running and went to see what happened to Chester. Chester had passed out in the trench and was just lying there. They pulled him out of the trench, and then everyone went to the nearest bar for a beer, and the next day they were all back to work. Dad had worked on jobs on the sides of mountains, and he had set dynamite and did just about every dirty job the company had ever asked him to do and more. Chester also worked and gave everything he had for a construction company that had no feelings for the lives or the sweat and blood that a few strong-backed men spent their lives giving out on hot, dirty back roads. My mom and dad loved to go fishing, so every weekend we all went fishing. That was a great place to fish, and we caught our limit almost every time we went fishing. My leg was getting better, but it was still stiff. I had my bike, and I started riding it, and I bent my leg enough to ride the bike, but it wasn't easy. I rode back in the hills and found this pretty lake and looked at the sky so big and full of soft clouds. I was very lonely, and I got a letter from Jan, and she told me about all the things her and Carol were doing. I had all these feelings inside me. I didn't know what they were, and my mind couldn't sort them out. All I knew was Carol and Jan were together. Bo sent me these two letters, and they were beautiful. I couldn't believe she was real. The depth and warmth and feelings were so fine. I never met a woman like her before. I kept reading the letters over and over. She had the most beautiful insides I ever seen. That was the most important thing in the world, to be beautiful inside, because your insides is the real you, and that's the part that a person has to know and love. I got home, and Bo came over and invited me to dinner. We talked for hours, and she told me she knew I was gay. She said she had been in love with this girl before she was married, and the girl had died. She said, "I remind her of that girl." That was really something, to love someone and then for them to die. I thought that was the deepest of heartbreaks. She was a fine person, and she always smiled and looked at the world in such a cheerful, understanding way. Her husband, Mike, seemed to be a nice guy. He had a job working for the state, and he was home only on weekends. They invited me to go everywhere with them. I didn't know much about kids because I never was around them much. Nicky, Bo's youngest boy, was 2. No one liked him, and he just ran around crying all the time. He was his dad's favorite, and Mike just packed him around all the time when he was home. All the kid would eat was fried eggs, and no one could do anything with him. This one night, we were coming back from going swimming, and Nicky was laying in the front seat, asleep. His face was all dirty, and he was a mess. He looked like a poor, lost little kid that no one loved. I decided right then I was going to be friends with him, and somehow I thought I knew how he felt. Ricky was a smart little kid, and he was 8. He acted like a little old lady and had a vocabulary better than most grown-ups I knew. He showed me his bug collection, and I talked Bo into letting him keep his bugs in the house. He told me all about his school and showed me his grades, and they were really good. He was really a nice kid. Ricky was not Mike's son, but Mike adopted him. Bo had Ricky before she married Mike. Bo didn't think Mike treated Ricky right, and Ricky felt his dad didn't either. Ricky didn't know he was adopted, and Mike wasn't his real father. I started spending most of my time over at Bo's, and everyone was so nice. We would all sit out in the front yard under this tree and talk and drink beer. All the neighbors would come over, and we would laugh and have a great time. The lady that lived next door to Bo was going to have a baby. Her husband came home one night drunk, and she was having some pains, so he said she was having the baby, and he was going to deliver it. He rubbed lard all over his hands and started trying to pull her baby out of her. He almost killed her and the baby before the kids could get the neighbors to stop him. Bo and I drove over to her sister Dee's house. When we got there, the place was full of cops. Dee's boyfriend Banks had spit in the lady next door's face, so her 2 sons had worked him over with a hammer. Banks and Dee came over to the car, and Banks had blood all over him. "Banks, get in, and we'll take you to the hospital." "I ain't going to no motherfucking hospital. I'm going to go out and find those motherfuckers and kill them." You can sign a complaint against them. Well, I ain't signing nothing. I'm gonna kill them. Well, I was glad when we left, and I do think that was something else. Banks was one mean mother, and he was always into something. The next time I saw him and Dee, he was real quiet and nice and didn't even seem like the same guy. That was the way Banks was. And he had everyone scared of him. And he could really pull some stuff and get away with it. He beat Dee up real bad. And she came over to stay with Bo because she was afraid he was going to kill her. Both Dee's eyes were black and her face was all messed up. She really looked awful. My mom and dad didn't like Bo and wanted me to quit going over to her house. I didn't want to stop going over there. They were all so nice to me and liked me, and I liked them too. We were sitting in Bo's living room talking, and it was about 1 o'clock and everyone was asleep. I stood up to leave and Bo came over to me and was standing so close to me and was looking at me. I couldn't help it. I kissed her and we went into the bedroom and I took her clothes off and started making love to her. I kept thinking I must be out of my mind. There I was making love to a married woman and a whole house full of people. The next night we got on my bike and rode up in the hills, and there on a hill under the stars I made love to her again. She filled me with warmth and she came to me wholly, and I knew she loved me. She was so open and giving, and her soft sweetness made explosions inside of me, and we came together and held each other in the deepest moments of my life. We laid there looking at the stars and feeling each other's warmth and knew we couldn't stand to be apart again. Words couldn't express what we felt, and we looked at each other and knew how it was. Her arms were around me as we rode under a sky filled with stars, and the wind was soft and gentle. I drove slow because I didn't want her to leave me, even if just for a night. When we got back to my house, Jan and Carol were there, and they said Mike was looking for Bo, and he was really mad. They said they were leaving because they didn't want to get involved. Bo and I went over to her house, and Mike came out the door screaming, "I'm going to wrap that bike around your neck, Sharon. Just try it." Bo started talking to Mike and told him to go home. I didn't want to leave her with him so mad. She said she could take care of everything, and so I went home. She called me and told me to come over for coffee, and Mike was real nice. She was a real good talker. Mike left for the week, and then I started staying there until daylight every morning and then going home before my mom and dad woke up. It was really something sneaking around like that, always worried about getting caught. I couldn't keep away from her, and when Mike was home on the weekends, I thought I would go nuts. I loved her, but she was married, and I didn't want to break up someone's marriage. She told me her marriage was over before she met me, and she didn't love Mike. She loved me, and she was going to get a divorce. I felt like a leaf caught in the middle of a storm. Everything was happening so fast, and all I could do was silently stand by. Bo and Dee figured out how Bo could get a divorce, and they planned how Bo would tell Mike. Bo talked to Mike, and they went over everything, and she was very kind to him. He seemed okay until he came to get his clothes. He started yelling and cussing, and Bo told him to leave. Then he stood out in front of their house screaming at the top of his lungs that we were two queers. "You dirty bitches, go ahead and sit around and suck each other off. I don't give a fuck. I'm going to fight you motherfuckers in court, you dirty cocksuckers, you lousy goddamn queers." Then he went around to all the neighbors and told them about how I broke up their marriage and turned his wife queer. Then he went to everyone in Bo's family and to every friend they had and told them too. Everyone in Martinez and Concord knew about us after Mike got through. He said he was going to go over and tell my parents. I told him to go ahead and my dad would punch him in the mouth. He didn't go over there, but they still heard about everything. We would get in the car to go somewhere, and everyone would stare at us like we were some kind of weird freaks or something. My mom and dad begged me not to go over to Bo's house anymore, and my mom said, "Sharon, everyone is saying you broke up Bo and Mike's marriage." It was really awful. It was like everyone in the world was against us. We knew we had to move away from the neighborhood. I sold my bike and got $100 for it, and we rented a two-story house in Martinez. Dee rented the bottom part of the house, and we rented the top part. My mother begged me not to move in with Beau and said she hated Beau. She cried when I left and said I wasn't any daughter of hers. I made my mother cry. I felt like a dirty D.O.B., and my dad said he knew I wasn't any good. Wow, I really did it this time. So that's a sample of this 24-chapter novel with some of the clearest English I've ever read in the English language. It's just incredible, beautiful. She rewrote it 15 times, I think she told me, to get it just exactly right. Now I'd like to run through some poetry by some other people, some of it from Lesbian Speak Out. Sunny, who is one of the six of us that worked on Lesbian Speak Out for years and years, is sitting here grinning at me. Lesbian Speak Out is a private joke because it's the press albatross. It's taking much too long to do. It's 3 years anyway, and it'll be another 6 months before it's out, probably. But it's a collection of articles, most of them old articles, and poems and drawings and photographs. It's 160 pages long, I think. And we're having to print it one page at a time, which is what's taking us so long. So some of these are from that book, just as a preview of it. This one's by Jerry Robertson. It's called Macrame. I sitting, tying the knots of thread hanging before me, each knot bringing memory of my mother. Mother, your looks hated us. Three times you tried to give your being worth, three painful creative failures. If only one could be boy child, boy, exploding from your womb, that would give reason, that would pay the price for the air you breathe. But we, all three, were only girl children, and we knew in the looks you gave us, as you knew when your mother looked at you, that you, she, had failed because we, you, were of no more value than you, she. This is a book printed by another press, another women's press in the Bay Area called Mama's Press. They've put out four things, I think. A children's book called The Monster Coloring Book, and two books of Susan Griffin's poems, and a book of Alta short stories. Those are all local Bay Area writers, and they're all very good. I thought I'd read a few of Susan Griffin's and just hold up the book, trying to arouse a little enthusiasm for the women's small presses, which are staggering behind somewhere, desperately trying to work out distribution network and put out women's material that we think wouldn't get printed other places. Or if it did, it would be in a completely different form. This is a poem for a woman doing dishes. This is a poem for a woman doing dishes. It must be repeated. It must be repeated again and again, again and again, because the woman doing dishes, because the woman doing dishes has trouble hearing, has trouble hearing. And this is another poem for a woman cleaning the floor who cannot hear at all. Let us have a moment of silence for the woman who cleans the floor. And here is one more poem for the woman at home with children. You never see her at night. Stare at an empty space and imagine her there, the woman with children, because she cannot be here to speak for herself and listen to what you think she might say. This is called Reason. I may not be reasonable, but I'm right, she said. I may not be right, but I am reasonable, he said. I can show you by reason that I am right, she said. I can make you unreasonable by force, he said. This is Susan Griffin's answer to a man's question, what can I do about women's liberation? Wear a dress. Wear a dress that you made yourself or bought in a dress store. Wear a dress, and underneath the dress, wear elastic around your hips and underneath your nipples. Wear a dress, and underneath the dress, wear a sanitary napkin. Wear a dress and wear slingback high-heeled shoes. Wear a dress with elastic and a sanitary napkin underneath and slingback shoes on your feet and walk down Telegraph Avenue. Wear a dress with elastic and a sanitary napkin and slingback shoes on Telegraph Avenue and try to run. Find a man. Find a nice man who you would like to ask you for a date. Find a nice man who will ask you for a date. Keep your dress on. Ask the nice man who asks you for a date to come to dinner. Cook the nice man a nice dinner so the dinner is ready before he comes and your dress is nice and clean and wear a smile. Tell the nice man you're a virgin or you don't have birth control or you would like to get to know him better. Keep your dress on. Go to the movies by yourself. Find a job. Iron your dress. Wear your iron dress and promise the boss you won't get pregnant, which in your case is predictable. And you like to type, and be sincere and wear your smile. Find a job or get on welfare. Borrow a child and get on welfare. Borrow a child and stay in the house all day with the child, or go to the public park with the child, and take the child to the welfare office and cry and say your man left you, and be humble and wear your dress and your smile, and don't talk back, keep your dress on, cook more nice dinners, stay away from Telegraph Avenue, and still, you won't know the half of it. Not in a million years. This is the last one of Susan Griffin. She occasionally writes articles in Ramparts magazine. I think she teaches. She has a small daughter, and she's had poems in several different places, I think. And she does readings every once in a while. Love should grow up like a wild iris in the fields, unexpected after a terrible storm, opening a purple mouth to the rain with not a thought to the future, ignorant of the grass and the graveyard of leaves around, forgetting its own beginning. Love should grow like a wild iris, but does not. Love more often is to be found in kitchens at the dinner hour, tired out and hungry, lingers over tables in houses where the walls record movements, while the cook is probably angry and the ingredients of the meal are budgeted, while a child cries, "Feed me now," and her mother, not quite hysterical, says over and over, "Wait just a bit, just a bit." Love should grow up in the fields like a wild iris, but never does really startle anyone. Was to be expected, was to be predicted, is almost absurd. Goes on from day to day, not quite blindly, gets taken to the cleaners every fall, sings old songs over and over, and falls on the same piece of rug that never gets tacked down, gives up, wants to hide, is not brave, knows too much, is not like an iris growing wild, but more like staring into space in the street, not quite sure which door it was, annoyed about the sidewalk being slippery, trying all the doors, thinking, if love wished the world to be well, it would be well. Love should grow up like a wild iris, but doesn't. It comes from the midst of everything else, sees like the iris of an eye when the light is right, feels in blindness and when there is nothing else, tender, blinks and opens face up to the skies. That's Susan Griffin. That's from Let Them Be Said. She has two small books of poetry out. The other one's called Dear Sky, and they're both printed by Mama's Press, another small press. Brave and poor.
And I suggest you rush down to Labris Bookstore, 33 Barrow, and see if you can obtain some of these books. I think they'll have some of it in stock. If they don't, tell them to get it in stock. Tonight's program was produced by Martha Shelley and Rebecca Butnalka. We'll be back next week. So until then, hold your breath.